Chris Graham for More Beer joins me this week to discuss fermenters. This is Beersmith Podcast number 177.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit Beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 177, and it's early September 2018. This week, Chris Graham joins me to talk about selecting the perfect fermenter. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They have a new Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine podcast, which I encourage you to check out. It features some of the top craft brewery owners and brewmasters discussing brewing techniques and flavors in beer. It's the podcast for those who make and drink great beer. You can find it on iTunes or at beerandbrewing.com/podcasts. And also the BrewVision thermometer from Blickman Engineering. This interactive wireless digital thermometer connects right to your iPhone or iPad and lets you remotely monitor and record temperatures. You can download your recipes right from the Beersmith Cloud and set updates and alerts as you brew. Get the BrewVision Bluetooth thermometer today. Another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 is available now for download. Upgrade to Beersmith 3 today. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith platform, along with new integrated water profile and mash pH tools. Dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for fruit, juice, and honey, as well as new Whirlpool hop options. Download your free 21-day trial and get Beersmith 3 today from beersmith.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Chris Graham. Chris is the president of More Beer and More Flavor, Inc. at morebeer.com. It's one of the top online sellers of brewing ingredients and equipment. He also teaches brewing at the world-renowned Seibel Institute. Chris, it's great to have you back on the show.
Hey, Brad. Thanks for having me.
So how have you been? How are things? You recovering from HomebrewCon, I hope?
Oh, yeah. It takes a few weeks for the liver to recover, but it was a great time. And a ton of fun this year.
And the twins are doing well, I hope?
Twins are doing great. They started kindergarten yesterday, so my wife's pretty happy.
That's pretty exciting. That's awesome. Well, today we wanted to talk about fermenters. And of course, there's just a ton of new options that have come on the market just in the last couple of years. Back when I started, I think the options were basically either a bucket or a glass carboy. So I thought maybe we'd start by talking about basic options that a lot of people start with a kit that just has a bucket to start with.
Exactly. And I think nowadays the buckets are pretty fancy. They're actually most of the time made for home brewing or at least designed around it with a spigot in the bottom and a lid with a hole purposely cut for the grommet or stopper for the airlock. When I started, it was the first kit I had, which was a homebrewing kit sold by a homebrewing store, but had a trash can. And it had the trash can manufacturer on the bottom stamped in there. But it worked great. I mean, you're going to get at least a few batches out of it before you pick up any potential colors or odors, as long as you have successful batches those first few times.
And a lot of the newer ones are food grade, right? Which helps instead of just using, you know, like you said, an old trash can or something.
Exactly. And when I first started, this was a trash can. I think it might have even had some sort of like recycle stamp on there or whatnot. So at least it was recyclable. But then I started going and dumpster diving essentially at a manufacturing place where I lived at the time in Eugene, Oregon, that made donuts. And they had all these cool white buckets out back that were for the different jellies and such that they would put into it. And don't ever use those because apparently you can never get those smells out.
Well, that is one of the disadvantages of working with many plastics, right?
Exactly. And you know, easily scratched and hard to get odor and color out of.
And another problem I ran into early on is sometimes the lids don't seal well. Now, I know many of the newer ones are better, but some of the old ones in particular didn't seal all that well.
They're still not better. The bigger the opening, the harder it is to get a good seal. And buckets are great for that. They're open. You open the top, and pretty most of them are 100% surface area to get in and clean easier, see what's going on. But when you have that much perimeter to have a perfect seal at, that often doesn't happen. Personally, I don't worry when a bucket doesn't seal perfectly for the first stages of fermentation. It's okay if I don't see airlock activity as long as I know fermentation's going on, because you're off gassing, you're putting out air, and it's not such a gap that it's going to let in flies or bacteria. So I think for the most part, people worry a lot about that seal, but that seal shouldn't really be an issue until fermentation is over.
Yeah, I think the problem I ran into is I was really impatient when I was first brewing. And so if I saw it not bubbling anymore, I would start, you know, getting ready to bottle it or something.
And then I had a couple bottle bombs
because of that, you know.
Oh, really? Oh, really? Sure. I would love to say I'm patient now, but I'm really not. So I'd probably do the same thing.
And then I think a lot of us moved into glass carboys, right?
Glass carboys, and I remember hearing that name for the first time, wondering who came up with this name. I'm assuming it's a French name, but they are, like, in my mind, they were the gold standard 25, 30 years ago of homebrewing. And that's just looks like your typical water bottle. It's just made out of glass. And they were the bee's knees. And at the time, most of them came out of Europe and were super thick. You know, while they felt delicate, they also felt like they could last a lifetime.
Yep. And the advantage of a glass, of course, it's very easy to clean, right?
Super easy to clean. You can see right through it, which is, I think, the biggest advantage. But easy to clean. But they have their flip side, which is they're extremely dangerous. The amount of people I've met over the years, and I'm sure you have too, who have accidentally had one slip from them, the natural human instinct is to catch what's falling. And Colin, who works for us, did that. And he said he literally felt the shape of it changed, and he knew that was a very bad thing. And I've heard others with just horror stories of shards of glass where shards of glass should not be.
Yeah. But you know, it is, I think the other thing is impermeable, right? Too. And of course, the other nice thing is you can get handles for them and stuff too now, which makes it a little bit easier to handle, right?
Carriers, they make carriers, handles. I wouldn't pick one up by the handle, when it's full, but they're great when they're wet and empty and wet, because that's when glass is the most slippery. So no, there are good ways. In fact, there's a company now making these bumpers. They're just foam bumpers. Strategically, you place them at the bottom, and that I think really makes a big difference. Because I noticed for myself, when I had problems with carboys, it was almost always at the bottom, and I blame them mostly on myself, which is, you know, picking them up and placing them back onto concrete. Over time, you just pick up little fissures, little cracks, that eventually you go to pick up the carboy and the whole bottom stays on the ground, because there's just enough cracks that connected, and the stress of lifting it makes it fall apart.
Okay, so I think we covered that, and I actually still use both of those for mead and in wine, because they're a little less tolerant or less sensitive to oxygen and stuff. And they, you know, long storage. Actually, glass is great for long term storage.
That is my preferred method for anything long term. For anything that's going to age, wine, I love glass carboys. And so with all those things said, we have lots of them still in use. And personally, I still use them. I don't typically use them for primary fermentation anymore. You know, your 1 to 2 weeks, I tend to use them, like you said, for long-term aging. They don't let as much vapor come out because of the neck that comes up. So you end up, I think, with less evaporation going on. And a great oxygen barrier.
Yeah, I just, if I've got a mead or a wine that I'm going to age for 6 months or a year or more, I just pump a little CO2 actually into the top of the carboy and let it go like that.
Another cool thing we use are glass marbles.
Oh, yeah, to offset to get the volume up, I guess. instead of topping it off. Because I know a lot of wine kits, you have to top it off and so on. But we're on a bit of a tangent. So moving beyond those two options, things really expand quite a bit from here. And there's literally dozens of new fermenters. What comes into play when you're trying to select from this plethora of new options?
Well, let's talk about some of those new options. So a great development that happened with the glass carboy, because its shape is wonderful, its size is wonderful, is people started making carboys out of better plastics. So where your white bucket's typically HDPE, it's very soft plastic, it's scratchable, or more easily scratched. They started then making it out of PET, soda bottle material, crystal clear, and has much better oxygen barrier properties. So the original company to do that is the Better Bottle, and those still sell quite well. But now there's actually two or three other ones that are out there doing quite well as well, at very good price point, very safe, easy. They also take the weight down quite a bit on a glass carboy to a plastic.
So you're basically talking about a plastic carboy, right?
Exactly. But there are varying plastic carboys. If you're looking at those, the kind you see water delivered to with Arrowhead, that's usually not PET. You want to make sure you're using one that is oxygen barriered. And so those are hugely popular. And then there's one like that that has a wider neck called a Fermonster. So take all the advantages of a plastic carboy, but then put I think it's a 4 or 5 inch screw cap top on it. So now you can get in and clean it easier. You can get your whole arm down in there. You can add hops a lot easier. But you get all those other benefits. The one you have on the screen now, Spiedel, similar German company, and these sell incredibly well. A very high quality white plastic bucket that they've done different finishes on. It makes it very easy to clean. They have good oxygen barriers, and on our wine side of things, those sell very well, especially for the size of them. They sell all kinds of size and the price points they come in at.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we're talking about a huge variety of prices here. I think when we talk about a plastic bucket, most of them are started under $10, right? And and you can go up into the thousands for some of these stainless steel things, right?
Exactly. It's amazing what's out there. And it's funny because everyone kind of has their own reasoning why they want it. One of the last ones I want to touch on, you showed Spiedel, but then there is the Demijohns, which historically, in my mind, have always been a winemaking product because these are glass carboys that hold like 15 gallons of liquid in them. So they weigh a ton. But I've heard more and more homebrewers using them lately. Not lately, but just over the last few years. Because people are brewing bigger batches, and they come in a plastic basket to make them a little bit easier to carry. But that kind of rounds out your glass and plastic traditional fermenters, is that idea of a solid bottom and the opening at the top.
Okay, and then what are some of the other options and considerations that come into play?
Well, I'd say, so we have our materials, and you have your plastic, glass, and stainless. So those are your three variables that I tell people to first start with. Plastic is inevitably going to be less expensive than glass or plastic or glass or stainless, mainly from a low cost to produce once you've made molds and things like that, lighter to transport and less likely to break than glass. So they tend to have your best price point, but from a material standpoint, they're not as inert as glass or plastic or stainless are. So they're more vulnerable to scratching, hazing over time, picking up colors, picking up aromas that might not come out as easily. But in that world, you have your plastic buckets, and then we showed some of the more expensive ones like the Spidels. But now there are three very popular conicals, the Fermentosaurus, the Fast Ferment, and the Catalyst, all made out of plastics. And you know, now you can kind of get into this world of conicals, which we'll talk about in a little bit, at a much, much lower price point than when you're talking stainless. So then you have glass fermenters, which I think used to be the gold standard for homebrewers because of the price point. They are commonly used in other applications. So people were making them by the thousands for acid storage and other things that we were able to take advantage of to use for fermentation. But they break easier, obviously, and harder to ship, heavier, and harder for the homebrewer themselves to handle without fear of them breaking. So you just have to have more caution when using glass. And then stainless is, I think, now the gold standard to what glass was 20 years ago. Stainless is what most homebrewers eye for the long term, because it is a material that's great for long term. Let's face it, it's what the pros use who do, you know, we do it as a hobby. The pros are doing it professionally, and this allows us to mimic what they're doing easier. For the most part, stainless should be inert, and so thusly could be cleaned, sanitized over and over and over again without as much issues as plastic might have, and you know, without the breakability that stainless can have.
Okay, well, let's walk through some of these, and let's talk first about the conicals, because I think once you get away from you know, a flat bottom fermenter, be it a pail or a carboy or something, or a bucket, brew bucket, I guess, kind of the next step up is a conical. What are some of the advantages of using a conical fermenter and moving up to a conical fermenter?
So I'm going to be honest. I think most of us like it originally from the standpoint of how can I emulate the professional version of my hobby the most. And you know, you never see a bucket at a big brewery. That would be kind of funny to see just a flat bottom bucket there. So
yeah, I've seen bright tanks that are flat, but not the
bright tanks definitely should be, or at least pan bottom, but fermenters themselves, the conical portion at the bottom serves a couple of purposes. One, it makes it easier to be able to remove most of the solids easily. You know, you can see from the 60 degree cone, and even if it's not a perfect 60 degree cone, the concept of most of the solids will slide down to the bottom and be more easily removed from that bottom dump valve. With that said, as you're going to choose one yourself as a homebrewer, you want to look at the size of the port of that valve. Yeast, hop, trube, things like that is very thick and clumpy. And if it's a little tiny 3/8 opening, it's going to be really hard to get most of that through. And I think most of the conical fermenter people realize that and have gone as big as they can go to really let that come out easily. So that's, to me, one of the first benefits is being able to separate out things I don't want for my whole fermentation by pulling out the bottom dump. What that also gives you is different tank hydraulics, meaning the fermentation, we all, you know, if you've had a glass carboy, you've probably spent far too much time watching the fermentation cycle, where you could see the yeast lifting, or well, technically the CO2 that the yeast is off-putting, lifting things up and cycling through, which is great because it actually distributes the yeast nicely and gets it access to sugars. Well, that 60 degree cone really makes a nice column that helps fermentation actually accelerate, meaning the yeast get faster access to the sugars, you have less dead spots in the fermenter. So typically you can shorten a fermentation a little bit by having it in a conical fermenter. Then there's also some flavor profiles that can come from conicals, or actually technically can come more from flat bottoms, more angles can produce different flavors than avoiding those by having the conical bottom.
And then any other comments on the conical shape?
I think that's the main reasons people would choose that conical shape. Now, a conical itself allows you a lot more features that you can do as well, such as adding extra ports to be able to draw cleaner beer. You know, if you look at most of the stainless ones, you'll not only have the bottom dump, but you'll usually have one and maybe even two extra ports for sometimes a rotating racking arm. So that allows you to pull the cleanest beer off when going to your either bright tank or kegs, leaving behind as much yeast as possible. And then they usually even have the ability to rotate that to maximize the amount of liquid you get out of the fermenter. They also typically have sample ports. So during the fermentation, they make it real easy to draw off a small sample to test the sugar levels of your beer.
So as you get higher and higher up here, we've got more and more features as well. Before we leave the shapes, though, I wanted to discuss the brew bucket kind of concept, which some of them have, you know, not a conical bottom, but maybe a little bit of a cone at the bottom. Some of them are flat. What's the concept behind many of the brew buckets? A lot of them are stainless, of course, that we're seeing come up.
There's two very popular ones right now. Blickman makes one called with the Anvil line, and then SS makes one called the Brew Bucket, which in my opinion is the original bucket. And a couple of things they did nicely. That little cone at the bottom, like you said, neither one of those is there actually a dump valve on there, but they really collect all that true matter as it settles into a smaller spot than a traditional flat. It kind of helps pull it all to the bottom and helps it compact better. You can see on that brew bucket, there's also a little sample port off of the side cone, so it allows you, or not sample, but actually drawing your final liquid. They designed that one to be able to stack, so then you can actually fit a few in the place of certain fermenter or refrigerators and such, so you can actually stack them and still ferment and draw sample or draw your final product out of. And really what those came in nicely at in both varietals is the price point. You get this stainless material that, let's face it, unless you really do some damage to it, it's going to last forever. You could do all kinds of different crazy things with Brett's and such and have less risk. Easier to clean these. You can actually use harsher chemicals than some of the other plastics. If need be, you could take them up to heat, which is also nice if need be. So I think they just had a nice price point in getting those out there.
So those are popular though, I think, right?
Oh, good options. Extremely popular. And I'd say so most homebrewers still come into the hobby, use either a bucket or carboy. Many are going straight to carboys now, bypassing the traditional opaque bucket. And then their next investment often as they're progressing is the fermenter. And the price point on these is just a few hundred dollars as opposed to conicals, which you get, you know, kind of that doubling effect of cost.
Yeah, I'm so looking at the prices here. They're maybe a third the price of a full-blown conical stainless, right?
Exactly. So it's a gateway drug. It's a nice little easy way to get the good materials, good quality construction, but not at the high price.
Right. We've talked a little bit about that. I do want to go back and cover some of the plastic conicals and what are the typical features you might see on a plastic conical, what's the rough price point, and what are the disadvantages long term for something like that.
So the three main conicals in my mind are the catalyst, the fast ferment, which is in kind of its second iteration, and then the Fermentosaurus. So we'll start with the Fermentosaurus since you have it up on the screen. It is a PET material, so you can see through it, which is nice. It's the advantage that this one has is it's pressurizable over the other two plastic ones. So the guys who made this, they designed it around. The original molds were for these one-way kegs, so you could send a keg from the United States down to Brazil, and when they're done, they just recycle the plastic instead of trying to send the stainless keg back to the to the brewery. So those kegs are, those were great. Those guys made a mold to make that into a conical, which is kind of exciting because now you have a inexpensive thing that you can use at home, but you can, out of this same thing, you can ferment, carbonate, and serve all out of one vessel if you wanted to. So those sell really well, and especially at the price point, which I unfortunately have to look up.
Says 119 there, 120 bucks.
But. 120 bucks, and that's really going to be hard to beat. Yeah. But they're doing it by trying to do scale and using something of that scale to do there. Now, the flip side of that is pressurizable plastic has to be tested every few years. So really, we say those shells are good for carbonation and serving for 2 years. And then you can buy just the plastic part of that. And you can still use the shell for fermentation after that, but we don't recommend carbonating and serving. So you're talking about at least a portion of the expense being not a long-term investment.
So you can, but you can actually bring it up to full, 13 pounds or whatever serving pressure, right?
Oh yeah. Think of a soda bottle. I think you can bring them up even higher. Now, I think they don't recommend it because they've, breached it by, you have to put a little fitting in to put that bottom dump valve on there. It works incredibly well.
The other downside seems like it would be take a little space in the fridge though, right?
That was just where I was going. One of the flaws I think with it is its height. It's because it was made for something. It started with a mold for something else. It was kind of limited to certain variables. Well, they've sold enough that they went back, redid the tooling, and now they're working on a new version that maybe by Christmas time will be out. That will be slightly less gallons because this is 9 gallons, maybe more in the 7 gallon range and a little bit shorter to get you into a regular fridge instead of being so tall.
Yeah. And then one thing we haven't talked about, which is a nice feature of some of these though, is pressurized transfer. So you can also run the system, I think, at low pressure, right? And force the beer out with CO2 and basically get it into a keg without ever really touching any air, right?
You can do that, a nice closed transfer. You really avoid a lot of like the oxygen risks, not only oxygen itself, but airborne bacteria and spoilers. So that it works great for that. I've also had customers tell me they go through plate filters. Basic homebrew plate filter or cartridge filters just to do, a nice little filter before going into the keg. And they said they love it because it used to be clean and sanitize your keg, fill your keg, then you have to clean and sanitize another keg, and then transfer between the two. So this cuts down on their cleaning and sanitizing quite a bit, reducing the amount of kegs they have to clean and sanitize.
Okay, real quick, you want to hit the other couple big, the popular conical plastics?
So the Catalyst is another PET. It's a bit more expensive at $200, but it's a very well-built plastic conical. It does not do pressure, but the plastic itself is very thick, very clear, very nicely done. And they just did a really good job on that. And it comes in at a price point that's good, under $200. And this is a conical that's going to last a long, long time. Not that the Fermentosaurus won't, but it can't do its entire job, meaning the serving point, after it's past a couple years. Then the Fast Ferment, they've done a great job. This product was actually out in the market called a V-Vessel years ago. They didn't do that great of a job marketing it. Fast Ferment bought the company, bought the molds, re-rigged the molds to handle some of the problems they had with the seal at the top, made a nice little collection ball, made a nice little few improvements. And this is a fermenter that starts under $100, which I would have loved when I first started homebrewing to be able to have a conical under $100 that's built nicely and gonna last a long time.
So let's talk real quick features between the three. Do they have, you know, some of the features we're looking for here, I think, are what? Temperature monitoring ports, sampling ports. You mentioned the collection balls at the bottom.
All three have collection, and not all three do not have any sample ports that are native. They have like add-ons where you're basically puncturing the wall to be able to add on arms and sample ports and things like that. And then the only thing different about between the three of them that is different would be the Fermentosaurus, and that's only because of its pressurizability and the benefits that you could achieve from that, where the other two are not pressurizable.
And then I think the other feature that we're looking for is a temperature port where you could actually put a temperature gauge, ideally near the middle of the fermenter, right?
All three of them don't have one natively. You can add them usually by altering one of their tops and having a thermal well drop down in there.
Okay. So that covers those basic options. And let's go on to stainless steel, I guess, right?
Yeah, the new beginning of stainless steel, because, you know, 10 years ago, there was two choices for the most part, and that would have been Blickman and us for conicals. And our conicals are quite frankly very similar base conicals, different feature sets, but similar. We both looked at what the pros were using and did our best to make miniature versions of them. And have sold quite well. They last a long time. They're stainless. They're inert. And they're very high quality. But over the last, let's say, within the last 10 years, I'm looking at my cheat sheet here, and I see six other fermenters that have come along the way, one of them being a Blickman product as well called the Cornicle. But you have the SS fermenters. Spike has conicals. These brew kegs out of New Zealand, and they all offer different features, different qualities to them, and at different price points. So you can start with some of your least expensive ones. Let's say the SS Chronicles, which are a pretty nice fermenter, the one you have up on the screen, a $600 fermenter.
That's a half barrel too, which is bigger than most of us brew, I think.
Exactly. And so you get the full benefit of the extra size. You know that particular one there is not really pressurizable. You can see by the clamps that it just has spring-loaded clamps that'll hold the lid down to form the seal, so you can see the airlock, but you're not going to get some of the pressure transfers that you're going to be able to get with, let's say, ours or the Blickmans or even the SSs that are now meant to be uni tanks that can also be pressurizable as well.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember some of the early SS Brewtechs. You could do a pressurized transfer at like a couple PSI, maybe something like that, right?
Exactly. I think the one you just had on there, maybe 3 or 4 PSI, just enough to transfer, which for many people is great. But, you know, nowadays people want it all and they want to carbonate right in it as well, if possible.
Yep. So again, go over a couple of the options. I'll try and as you're talking, I'll try and pull some of them up here.
Yeah, pull one up and I'll just kind of go the opposite way.
Okay, well, there's the Brewtech sort of baseline version, so I guess. They have several different versions, though.
I was going to say, there's your baseline, but you'll notice they almost all have a bottom dump and a arm in there. I think that particular one's not a rotating arm, but some of their other ones, they do offer the rotating arm. A little bit above there, hard to see in the picture, is a temp thermal well. Some people put the thermal well through the side. Some people like to come in to the top, but almost all the stainless ones have those three core things of the bottom dump, the valve to be able to pull not from the total bottom, so you get your clear beer out of it, and a temp sensing area.
Yeah, I mean, these work really well too, because there's very little liquid left in the bottom of that cone when you drain the beer off. So
Exactly. You can very much maximize. One of the benefits I didn't really mention yet, and it's debatable amongst homebrewers, but if you're a very frequent homebrewer, you could really take advantage of being able to reharvest your yeast. I tell people who don't brew frequently or on any kind of schedule, reusing your yeast is a bit of a challenge if you're brewing erratically. But we've got some locals who brew, I mean, like clockwork, either every week or every other week, and they're doing a great job nowadays of at least getting a few reuses out of their yeast by using conicals, by dropping the hop matter and all the trub out, and then being able to get the first bit of yeast out, and then really collecting that good, healthy, looks like vanilla ice cream samples of yeast, and to be able to reuse that again in their next batch.
And you can wash it and reuse it even later if you're willing to do a starter and so on too.
Oh, exactly. It's like anything else. Yeast management can be its own little side hobby. So you could think of it like, yes, you could. You could actually plate it and then bring it back up if you wanted to, or you can do a wash and reuse it. Or some people who don't really want to do that kind of work just want to be able to reuse it once or twice without any extra special knowledge or handling. And usually you can do that fairly safely with a conical.
Yeah, and I like how the conical, you can just pull it. You know, you can see the bottom valve. You just pull it literally right off the bottom, and comes out like toothpaste. You know,
exactly, and that's why you want to make sure you don't end up with a tiny hole at the bottom. You want to make sure that can flow. But some of them now, like we have an attachment you could put on ours, and many of them have this now, some sort of collection ball or collection device that. Not only can you collect these, but you can do it pretty sanitarily. You're not just pouring it into an open mouth jar.
Yep. And it's nice. I think many of these, and I think the one we're talking about here, come with sanitized clamps as well. You can, or clamps, you can, you know, they're called tri-clamps. You can really easily sanitize them.
Exactly. The TC fittings, this one does at both the connections. Some will come, but you can see those are TC and a threaded fitting. Maybe that wouldn't be completely brewery grade, but it's a very nice compromise of price. Now, if you look at some of the other SS ones, the more expensive unitanks, those actually come with butterfly valves. Now, a butterfly valve is a $70 or $80 valve versus a $12 stainless steel ball valve. So each one of these feature sets adds a different level of cost.
Yeah, so they have a deluxe version here, I think, right?
Exactly, sort the of, Brewmaster version.
Okay, Brewmaster version, but basically it's a deluxe version that sells, that has some upgrades. And actually, I do want to ask, we'll go into some detail maybe at the end about the ball valves and some of the other options there.
Cool.
So that's the SS BrewTech. If you want to try and talk about one of the other ones, I'll try and find a picture of it here in a minute.
If you want to pull up either ours or Blickman's, again, similar.
Yeah, I don't have it immediately, that's but fine. If you can start talking about it, and I'll pull it up in a second.
So ours and Blickman, like I said, very similar. Good quality bottom dumps, a rotating arm. We always err on the side of welded. We like welded fittings whenever possible. That's one of the things when looking at the stainless is some are weldless, some are welded. I'm a big fan of welded because, you know, if done properly, then they'll never leak. They'll never, you know, you don't go to a brewery and say, hey, I don't see any weldless fittings on your equipment. And there's a reason for that. It's more expensive to do good welding, but it should be a forever thing when you weld it. Whereas with weldless, you are talking threads and you're talking gaskets and things that can give out over time or alter over time and need to be cleaned differently than a fitting that is welded in there. So, but both have good, ours have good bottom dumps, side ports, big clamps on the lid, so they are pressurizable, especially, you know, both of them great for transfers, but can handle some higher pressure ratings. I personally would just use it for transfers, but they're a very high quality stainless, thick stainless, and that's one of the hard things online to convey to people of what the thickness of stainless is. And it's great when you go to trade shows, people could pick them up and go, holy cow.
This is, yeah, I mean, you pick up like one of Blickman's pots, you know, and it's just, I mean, you could probably like shoot bullets at it, would bounce off kind of a thing. It's just, I mean, they're insanely over-engineered, right?
Yeah, and that, you know, but there are times where that's really nice to know, because you know that over-engineering is going to handle a bunch of, someone put it down heavily, it got knocked around in the storage area, it, you know, whatever happens, and still look beautiful and feel solid, where some of the ones coming out of China are starting to feel sometimes paper thin.
Yeah, it's not going to get dented like my, I have one of those Chinese, you know, five gallon ones that, you know, literally you could dent it with a pen probably, you know.
Exactly. And, you know, so usually, I mean, the adage of you get what you pay for is typically true in almost everything we're talking here. So it's one of these things when time comes to choose what you want to do. And I think we'll talk a little bit more about that. But, you know, I think the adage is usually you're paying for what you get, and especially in terms of materials. So if you're buying a very inexpensive stainless conical, odds are there's a reason that it's inexpensive, and that's okay. Doesn't mean it won't do its job. It's just, it may not be the same thickness or gauge of stainless as some of the other ones. Sometimes there are different grades of stainless. I mean, there are different grades. Some of them are made of different grades. You kind of want to make sure you're in the 300 series of stainless when choosing your stainless conical. You know, and in terms of their shape, they're all conical. Some have domed lids, which are nice because they allow pressurizing more, and they allow more to fit into it. And that's one of the key things is, you know, John actually is one of the first people who, the Blickman, who made a domed lid on the top, which was nice because you could make a, let's say, a 12-gallon conical into a 14-gallon conical to have that extra headspace for fermentation.
Yep, and then, absolutely.
And then a big difference we did, and we built this years ago, and we still sell quite a few of them, is Colin Kaminsky, who I think has been on your show. He works for us, and he helped us build a TEC cooled conical, meaning it's not glycol. You don't have to put your conical into a fridge. You don't have to have a glycol unit to run it on. It's actually a self-contained temp controlled conical. It's got a little heating pad. It's insulated. And then it's got cooling chips that are up near the top of the liquid line. And it's awesome for fermentation. It's really easy. It's very gentle cooling. It's not very aggressive, but it'll hold your fermenter about 30 degrees below ambient. For fermentation.
Wow. So let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about temperature control as we get into some of these high-end systems. I know the Brewmaster series and a number of others have temperature control options, right?
Yep. And temperature control, I think, has been a great subject in homebrewing for the last five years or so. Everybody who's doing these stainless ones are starting to try to figure out how do we encourage people to ferment their beer properly. The old way used to always be just stick it in a fridge. Well, some of these are showpiece items. They're beautiful. You don't want to stick them in a fridge that no one can see. Plus, fridges tend to not be very efficient. I mean, they're probably more efficient than I give them credit for, but we don't tend to use newer fridges. We tend to use old fridges. And many fridges don't have flat bottoms, so you kind of have to alter them to get the fermenters into them. So, you know, we have our TEC version of cooling, but what's really become popular over the last few years is something that SS built, which is they just called the FTSS, and it's simply just a stainless coil that's inside the fermenter that goes to a has a little pump and a temp controller that pumps ice water through. So you can set up a cooler of ice water. You can actually have the water in a kegerator and just lines that go through to be pumped around, but they just turn on and off the pump based off if the conical needs cooling or not.
Right. And I think they also have a heater option, right, too, as well. They have a small heater that goes on the bottom. And
exactly. Just your typical rubber-coated heater that you can attach to the bottom just to gently warm. And so anyone building their own, that's one of those key words. When you're cooling or warming, cooling, you can cool pretty aggressively, especially for cold crashing. But for fermentation, you want to go fairly slow in that temperature change. Same thing with heating. You don't want to apply super hot heat to your yeast if possible. You want to raise it up a little bit, because as soon as the yeast gets in the right operating range, it's going to take over and create its own heat during the fermentation.
Right. I think it's pretty rare to need heat, but it's possible, I guess, if you're in a really cold basement or something like that. So the basic concept here is you have like a bucket of ice water, or maybe a cooler full of ice water, and you have a little pump that turns on and flows that water right through the fermenter, right? Or through the coil and fermenter, I guess, right?
Yep. Most people are just throwing a submersible pump right into the ice bath, so they don't have to worry about priming or anything like that. And then the pump is connected to a temp controller, so it just turns on and off based off of the temperature. And then the sensor of the temp controller is generally in a port in the fermenter.
So in the thermal well for the fermenter, and then that cycles in on and off. So it's kind of a poor man's temperature control system, and I assume you can get down to at least ale fermentation temperatures, right?
Oh, yeah. No, you can get to lagers, too. It's just the colder you want to go, and on any of it, you have to be diligent. If you're going on a trip for 5 days, well, you either have to have your wife or husband or kids or neighbors add some ice to the system.
Right, because you're talking about adding ice every 12 hours or so, I'm guessing.
Depends on where you are in fermentation. In the beginning, yes. But then, you know, once you're done with primary, you may only have to add ice every 2 days. And it depends on how hot it is and depends what you put your ice in. I'm a proponent of using a cooler for it, because then you get the natural insulation of the cooler.
Yeah, I actually have one of these, and I use a cooler I use a cooler for the ice bath, obviously. And then I use just bottles of water that I freeze in the freezer, you know.
Oh, nice. Nice. Yeah. And that's good too. I mean, there are different theories of using crushed ice versus big blocks of ice. And you know, the rate of which they melt. So it depends on what process you're in to maybe what kind you want to use.
Yeah. And then there's other options as well, right? There's some new options, I believe, for temperature control.
So there are some different options. One is a aluminum coated, and it's coated, so you don't have to fear the aluminum rod that is also TEC. So it's meant for carboys and certain conicals that have different openings that goes down into the fermentation, and it's just bringing the coolness down in there. So that's one option that's been around maybe 2-3 years. Then glycol itself or cold water baths are popular. We sell a product called the Ice Master, which is, you can use glycol or you can use water, depends on how you want to set it up. But then you can have like a 10-gallon reservoir of ice cold liquid, whether it be glycol or water, and you can actually control a few different fermenters if you want to. And then there are straight up glycol chillers that are now the homebrewing size that are starting to hit the market. And SS has one. Catalyst is coming out with one. Grainfather is coming out with one.
We start to get to the pricey end of things, though. I think we start to talk about having your own glycol chiller in your basement, right?
Exactly. Yeah. The nice thing about glycol or what we call the Ice Master is that's when you can get into not the one-to-one relationship. It's easier to say, like, I'm going to have four fermenters and this one unit doing making enough cooling to handle all four of them, much like a brewery would do.
Yeah, because last time I looked at it, glycols are started by $1,000 and go up from there, I think, right?
Generally, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and then, of course, the other option for fermentation temperature control, of course, is to just use a freezer or a refrigerator, right? And you can buy a controller for that.
Exactly, or make a small cold box out of just 2-inch foam insulation from Home Depot. There's a number of different ways, and just put an AC unit on that. That's what Jamil used to do. But one of the simplest ones is chest freezers and fridges, and just put an external temp controller on them, and you have a very inexpensive and well-working temp control.
Yeah, so you can buy an old refrigerator for a couple $100s, or maybe even free in some cases, and just
look on Craigslist.
You sell temperature. A lot of people sell temperature controllers that they plug into, right?
Yeah,
they get you down to the temperature you need.
And there's a new brand on that we sell the heck out of called Inkbird. And, you know, it used to be temp controllers always hovered around $100 or maybe a little more or a little less, depending on their features. And Inkbirds bring that down to sub 40. So very inexpensive, easy to add on, and they do a great job.
Okay, real quick, I did want to hit, we were going to cover the ports and valves that are on some of the deluxe models real quick, and then we probably need to wrap it up after that.
Cool.
So you want to talk about, let's start with butterfly valves versus the traditional ball valve?
Yeah, so a butterfly valve, do you want to bring up a picture online, John?
I'll try while you're talking, but go ahead and describe it.
If you just search butterfly valve. Yeah. So I'm going to just talk for a second about threaded versus sanitary fittings. Threaded fittings, most of us are very familiar with. They usually have either two types of thread, NPT, national pipe thread, or BSPP, which is like a continuous thread. But
similar to a garden hose, right?
Exactly. That's the perfect way. Everyone has a garden hose, so I guess that makes the most sense. And it's just a ball valve you thread right onto there, but it's that connection that typically is not the sanitary part. The deal there is you have these threads, and to make sure those are bacteria-free, you have to take them apart pretty much every single time. And then when you're dealing with stainless, as opposed to brass, you don't have any lubrication to prevent them from galling and freezing together, so we use Teflon tape, just more places that things can be harder to sanitize. A sanitary fitting, which is also often called tri-clover, or sanitary or TC, those are kind of the nicknames for it. This is a flange system that you have two halves. They both have a gasket, so you put the gasket where they meet, they connect together, and then a clamp goes around the outside to lock them, to hold them together. And this is what you would see at any brewery, or most breweries, the way they're going to take their hoses on and off, the way they're going to take their valves on and off.
Yeah, the tri-clover fittings, and they're a little bit of a pain. You got to have like three hands to connect them up, but right?
You do until
you got a clamp and a gasket and...
Until you use them enough, and then you watch some of these brewers who can do it one-handed, like flip it around it, twist it three times, and they're done. But they are
sanitary, right?
They're sanitary, and so you can clean in place without taking them apart every single time. Well, the common on-off valve instead of a ball valve is what most of us homebrewers use, but again, a ball valve has hidden parts to it. So when you turn that ball, there's a backside, a shadow that sits in usually a Viton gasket. And that's the part that you can't really clean in place. And that ball pushes manually against that gasket. So there's no way to sanitize it in place. Where a butterfly valve literally has a gate that you just turn open and close.
I've got a picture of the butterfly valve up.
Well, that's a very industrial one. But yes, same concept where when you close it, that piece just rotates and just makes a perfect seal, and you can clean the backside of it, but there's no hidden pockets. And when it opens, it's pretty much except for the flange itself, which is a very small shadow, it allows a full flow to come right out of it.
Right. So that's great for dumping, that big thick paste that comes out of the bottom of your fermenter.
Exactly.
Right?
In fact, I use that thing sometimes as a paddle or a blade to cut. You just keep pumping it until you finally start getting that thick mess to come out of the bottom.
Yep. Okay, so I mean, those are some higher end options, right? You can go to the butterfly valves, you can go to the sanitary tri-clover fittings, right?
Yep, exactly. And that just adds cost, and it adds weight. Sometimes it's a little weird when you have a 7-gallon fermenter with two of these valves that weigh like 10 pounds each, it feels like. When they're empty, it feels like they're going to be a little front top heavy. When they're full, they're fine. But man, they sure do look nice.
And of course, let's just summarize here at the end. I think we're talking about some options that cost less than $10 all the way up to options that cost perhaps even thousands of dollars. Where's the sweet spot for a lot of homebrewers?
You know, I think just like any other hobby, you have people who just want the best and they go out and they buy the best. And is it always the best? Maybe for them it is. But my sweet spot is about like anywhere from 200 to 500. But I tend to be a very pragmatic, practical person in terms of when it comes to spending money.
You're a serious home brewer too. I mean, a lot of people aren't going to do that right off the bat. So.
Oh gosh, yeah. No. And I don't even encourage them to. You know, there's nothing wrong with a $10 bucket. Just understand that is not going to be a permanent solution for your homebrewing if your homebrewing is going to go on 20 years. Doesn't mean you're not going to use that bucket ever again. I probably still use some of my first buckets for sanitizer or for whatever. It's just you can never have too many buckets when you're brewing. So it's not like you're going to throw it away. But then as you get to, ooh, I want to do this beer and I want to age it a little longer, or maybe you picked up a bacteria infection or just something that made your beer not taste like, maybe I want to change materials and go to plastic to stainless, or an HDPE plastic to a either coated HDPE or PET. These are all little reasons you might want to advance what you're using as your fermenter. And yes, going to some of those is only $20 for a PET plastic fermenter. So it's not like an expensive thing to do, but it's double the price of the original getting into it. But a PET or plastic carboy should last 10 to 20 years, I would think, if treated nicely and cleaned after use. I think that's one thing homebrewers sometimes forget to do. And with plastic, the longer you let stuff sit on there, sometimes it's a little harder to get it off afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Chris. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing some of your knowledge about fermenters.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you again. My guest today was Mr. Chris Graham, who's president of More Beer, which you can find at morebeer.com. And he also teaches at the Seibel Institute. Thank you again, Chris.
Thanks, Brad.
A big thank you to Chris Graham for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They have a new Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine podcast, which I encourage you to check out. It features some of the top craft brewery owners and brewmasters discussing brewing techniques and flavors in beer. It's the podcast for those who make and drink great beer. You can find it on iTunes or at beerandbrewing.com/podcasts. And also Blickman Engineering, creators of the innovative new BrewVision wireless thermometer. Remotely monitor your brewing system from your iPhone or iPad, record data, set alerts, and grab recipes directly from the Beersmith cloud. The BrewVision thermometer, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 is available for download on both desktop and mobile platforms now. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider support, new Whirlpool hop options, support for high-altitude brewing, and a whole lot more for beer brewers. Check out Beersmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial today from Beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.